Mr. Roche.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Roach on behalf of the plaintiff, Bob Robert Muzikowski. The district court erred in many respects, in particular by applying the innocent construction rule to grant summary judgment against Mr. Muzikowski on all his defamation per se and false light claims. It did so also with respect to other claims, and it erred in other respects. I would like to address two particular errors that the court made with respect to the dismissal of the defamation per se and the false light claims. Preliminarily, I wish to advise the court that the appellate court's decision in Tuitt v. Corbett, upon which Judge Kokoris relied at page, I believe, 18 of his opinion, is before the Illinois Supreme Court. Petition for leave has been granted. In that case, it's been fully briefed and set for oral argument next Wednesday. It matters not for purposes of this appeal. Reversal of the Tuitt decision or the abandonment of the Illinois construction rule, which is being frontally and directly challenged in that appeal, is not critical here. First, Judge Kokoris violated the directives, the mandates of this court in its prior opinion. In the first appeal, this court reversed the dismissal of Mr. Muzikowski's defamation per se and false light claims and held that he had alleged legally sufficient claims, both per se and false light claims, and that they were not, as a matter of law, barred by the innocent construction rule.
Well, and of course, that was a decision, very importantly, based on the standards under Rule 12b-6 for federal pleading, which is not the same as the set of standards that Illinois applies to its defamation cases. What this court said is that he might be able to produce evidence showing that, as we said, no one could think that anyone but him was meant. But we also said if there is an innocent construction, then Paramount is entitled to produce that evidence. I mean, in other words, there's no holding in the first decision. It's the case goes forward. There's enough pleaded.
That's correct, Your Honor, although the court in its opinion did refer to the unusual amount of details which were provided in Mr. Muzikowski's complaint.
And warned that he came close to pleading himself out of court, but decided that that was not the case at that stage, that there was, you know, he might be able to get the next step.
Correct. But at that point, after this court's holding, and when it went back to the district court, after this court had made its threshold determination that as a matter of law, his defamation per se and false light claims were viable and legally sufficient, it is critically important that it went back to the district court with certain instructions. And in his first opinion, this court embraced the Illinois Supreme Court's case in Bryson, and it said, many similarities have been sufficiently alleged, and I quote, between himself and O'Neill that could cause a reasonable person in the community to believe that O'Neill was intended to depict him and that Paramount intended mischaracterizations to refer to him.
Right, but then we went on to say it's also entirely possible that Paramount will be able to produce enough facts to support its innocent construction argument. So it's not enough. I mean, what worried me about your brief is you seem to think that it's enough to show that somebody might think that O'Neill and Muzikowski are the same person. That may be necessary, but it's not sufficient. You have to also show that no one could think it's anyone else but Muzikowski. No reasonable observer.
I agree up to a point, Your Honor. We are not taking the position that once this court blessed the legal sufficiency of the allegations as opposed to evidence of record, that we were home. Absolutely not. However, this court set the standard and repeated the standard set forth in Bryson that we were required to meet.
And it meant, for example, that the fact that the name was O'Neill and not Muzikowski was not fatal to your case, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
But we went back to the court. They filed, as they were entitled to, a motion for summary judgment. We were then required, as this court told us. In fact, I suggest that you, in your opinion, invited them, Paramount, to produce facts to establish their innocent construction defense. I suggest they did not do so. In the motion for summary judgment that was granted by Judge Koukouras, we came forward, and as this court, in its opinion, had told us to do, supported each and every key allegation with evidence of record.
How did your evidence exclude the possibility that a reasonable observer would not think of Mr. Muzikowski? I mean, you didn't do any surveys in the Chicago area of strangers to Mr. Muzikowski. How did you exclude that possibility?
There was evidence of record, Your Honor, that there was, the movie was perceived by people who did not know Mr. Muzikowski portray him.
I mean, are you talking about the 18 affidavits, or are you talking about something else?
I'm talking about something else. A news, and they're all in the record. Movie reviews, the AP article in October of 2000, where it was stated that Keanu Reeves plays Bob Muzikowski.
Right, but so that, again, I can see that as evidence on the positive side. How do those things exclude the possibility that it might be something else? I mean, there were other newspaper articles, for example, that didn't draw that connection.
I suggest, Your Honor, it was not our burden to show that it could be nobody but Mr. Muzikowski.
That may be where we have a problem, because it's Mr. Muzikowski who's the plaintiff here. So he does have the burden of showing, you know, the defamation. And what we said in our earlier opinion is that Muzikowski might be able to produce evidence showing there's, in fact, no reasonable interpretation that would support an innocent construction. That's on page 927 of the opinion. And maybe this is about who has that burden, but what we said was that it was up to Mr. Muzikowski to come forward. It's hard to prove a negative, but these are difficult cases to prevail on.
I suggest that the reference you're referring to, page 927, Your Honor, was not part of the court's holding as to what the standard is, what the obstacle is that Mr. Muzikowski has to satisfy. And I suggest that standard was set forth two pages earlier, page 925, when this court said he had sufficiently alleged to get by a motion to dismiss, it should be the same for a motion for summary judgment. And I quote, many similarities between himself and O'Neill that could cause a reasonable person in the community to believe that O'Neill was intended to depict him. He was not required to show that absolutely no one could think it was anyone other than Muzikowski. That is not the law, and you think about it, it's an absolutely absurd and ridiculous standard to impose on a plaintiff in a defamation per se case, because there would be no claims.
Right, no, but I think maybe to get back to the technicalities of pleading, remember at 12b-6 in the federal system, you have to ask, is there any set of facts out there in the world that the plaintiff the plaintiff could come forward with which would support the claim as asserted? And if so, then the person is entitled to go on. But then at the summary judgment stage, you have to go out and get those facts. And I think that's the difference. It's that intermediate stage that we spend so much time on in federal court, where he then had to go find, it's not like every last living, breathing person, but is there any reasonable interpretation that could support an innocent construction? And you need facts at the summary judgment.
To support an innocent construction or Mr. Muzikowski's defamatory construction?
Mr. Muzikowski has to exclude the possibility of an innocent construction.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, as a matter of law. And I refer to this court's opinion, but more importantly, the decision in Bryson. In Bryson, you had, before the court, in Bryson, the Illinois Supreme Court had two possible constructions, a innocent one and a defamatory. And they held that, contrary to the position taken by the defendants, when you have two possible constructions before you of record established by fact, you are not, under Bryson, required to take the innocent construction, lights out, party over, go home, because innocent automatically trumps defamatory. No, to the contrary. Bryson said, now you go on to the trier of fact. and have that tried before a jury. And if I would suggest, there is a distinction. These cases are somewhat amorphous. I think there's a way to reconcile them. In the cases relied upon by the defendants, they all involve a judicial threshold determination of whether or not the publication, the work at issue, is defamatory. And that is a judicial determination at the very incipient stage. However, when you think about it, that determination, albeit somewhat mixed question of fact and law, the court has the advantage of having the four corners of the newspaper article, the work, the TV broadcast, whatever it is, before it. And it's akin to interpreting a contract by a court. So those decisions, and I would call those contents decisions, are they stand in stark contrast to the other cases, and there are very few of them, but a different test, I suggest that the innocent construction rule is applied differently in what I call the unnamed plaintiff cases, such as Bryson. And when you think about it, when the court is being called upon to make this threshold determination of whether or not the defamatory work refers to someone other than the plaintiff, it is, by definition, required to go outside the pleadings, conduct a very broad and far-ranging factual investigation, as in this case, after extensive discovery, 100,000 pages of documents, 10 depositions, and for that very reason, I suggest that courts are reluctant, because it comes so perilously close to usurping the function of the trier of fact, here the jury, of deciding whether or not the plaintiff is the
Mr. Rose,
person
let me ask you,
misportrayed.
What was the source of these newspaper articles?
We don't know, Your Honor. It didn't come from Mr. Mazakowski, and there's no evidence in this record indicating.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that oftentimes to promote movies, the studio itself will provide information to media outlets.
An inference could be drawn that that's where it came from.
Well, but I don't want to draw an inference, but I've just suggested that's.
Well, there is evidence in the record that the studio did send out a marketing kit about the movie to 1,500 or 2,000 journalists throughout the country.
Was it the Orlando Sentinel that had specifically said that Keanu Reeves portrayed your client?
No, I believe it was an AP article, and it was it came out of a Detroit newspaper, the one that's in the record, possibly the Detroit Free Press. But
it was an AP story.
It was an AP and apparently a nationally circulated article. And if I could go back to our burden to come forward, which we did, summary judgment, I think it's critical to our appeal that the Paramount, they have a burden. They were the movement. They came forward with nothing. And in fact, that what they really did, and Judge Koukouras bought it, and by doing so he committed error, they went back and re-argued the innocent construction law and asked him to apply it as a matter of law. They no affidavits. They're the movement. They have to come forward and show that no reasonable person, or there are reasonable persons in the community who know both the plaintiff and the defendant, and they don't think it was Mazakowski. They think it was a total fiction or someone else. Not one affidavit did they come forward with. That was their obligation as movement. And that ties into the part of this court's prior opinion where it said, in a diversity case such as this, and this was this case, Illinois substantive law does apply. With the exception of federal procedural law, overrides any Illinois procedural law, the pleading requirements. I suggest to you, an analysis of Judge Koukouras' opinion indicates that he violated that mandate in this respect. Summary judgment, movement, their burden of proof coming forward, all reasonable inferences to be drawn in our favor as a non-movement. He violated every single rule incidental to the well-established body of federal law on summary judgment, who gets the benefit of reasonable inferences, what are their obligations to come forward, and they just didn't satisfy it. What he did, he used the innocent construction law, and that part of it, which I suggest, is procedural and flew in the face of Rule 56 by holding that, and this is contrary to Bryson also, where you have a possible innocent construction and a possible defamatory construction automatically the innocent prevails. He ignored the test under Rule 56. Is there a genuine issue of fact? And there was. It's a classic. We got Mazakowski with proof, compelling proof, exhaustive proof. They Nothing. You look at that record and see what they came forward with other than rehashing the legal arguments they made, which this court rejected on its first appeal. And if you look at the case law, and going back to my analogy, contents, where a court just looks at the contents to make the threshold determination, those cases as opposed to the very few unnamed plaintiff cases. And invariably, there is not one decision after Bryson, not one, where in an unnamed plaintiff case, where a plaintiff, the unnamed plaintiff, came forward with affirmative evidence and there was an innocent construction that was possible. There is no reported case, and I challenge Ms. Berman to cite one to you, where the court said, as Judge Koukouras did here, well, there's two possible constructions here. Automatically, the innocent prevails. Go home. No. We cited a number of cases where the same test involving an unnamed plaintiff was used. Let's look at the totality of the circumstances. Let's look at the facts. Let's look at discovery. And it's a fact-finding mission that in almost every case wound up going ahead to the trier of fact.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Andrew Brehm for the law firm of Scava, Roach & Zwirner in 053005. I'm here to address the sanctions part of the judgment entered by Judge Koukouras. Briefly, the sanctions judgment should be reversed because this was simply not a case that involved the type of willful, contumacious disregard of a court order that merits sanctions. Instead, what it really is a case where we have been sanctioned based on a perception that the court thought it entered an order which really was never entered, and confusion ensued, and sanctions resulted.
But even after that order was clarified, there was a substantial noncompliance period, was there not, before the sanctions were imposed?
Well, we disagree with that, and we disagree that there was, under the circumstances, any finding ever made to that effect. Namely, there was an order on June 9th, which said that we were to comply with, that said the motion to compel directing us to provide documents, identified documents supporting Mr. Munzikowski's contention was granted.
But, you know, the transcript that led to that order is all about what are you going to use at trial. Judge Koukouras says over and over again, you know, I used to be a trial lawyer, and you're going to have to do this sooner or later. And the lawyer is saying, I don't want to do it now. I want to do it later. And Judge Koukouras is saying, no, I want you to do it now. It's very hard for me to read that transcript and not end with the impression that at the end of that particular hearing, it was clear you were supposed to go identify the trial documents.
Well, two points on that, Judge Wood. One, even if it had been made clear, and we submit it was not clear because there was a directive, you're going to have to go for these documents to determine what you want for trial, so that transcript can be read as
so
we read it.
Do it now, yeah.
That you do it now, and you select the documents that support the contentions, and you're doing the review for two purposes. But more significantly, point number two is the order that results from that, and we submit as the written order that is the governing document says motion to compel is granted. You tie that back to the relief that they sought in their motion to compel, it's identify the documents supporting your contentions, not prepare a trial exhibit list. Now, had the court's directive been that we were to prepare what was tantamount to a trial exhibit list, the order, the written order, should have told us that. So we would not have had this confusion. Then it was back on July 1
so
where the train comes off the track.
To get back to it, obviously we have two different things. That is, the minute clerk, the courtroom deputy clerk, prepared it, I assume, and whatever internal procedures Judge Koukouras uses in his chambers, it issued. But you're saying that what the judge said during the colloquy with the counsel doesn't count?
It counts, but it was ambiguous. If it had not been ambiguous, perhaps we would have a different situation. But the judge said, he did say, for example, at one point in that transcript, and I think this is the key passage, he overruled our objections, saying that in preparing for depositions and preparing to defend this case, they, defendants, have a right to know expressly what documents you are relying on. Now, in the context of a motion to compel us to provide identified documents that support various contentions. We took it to mean relying on to support the contentions. The written order is consistent with that. What Judge Koukouras did not say at that point, although as Judge Wood articulated, there were references to needing to go through the exercise to get the documents, I think Judge Koukouras' words, that were sufficiently juicy and compelling to be actually be used at trial. True, but at this point he says, give me the documents you're relying on. But he does not say at trial, and I think the omission of those words is highly significant when read in light of the subsequent order, and he says, I'm going to require you to do that in 2 weeks.
And we're talking about Judge Sykes' point that then you get up to July 1st, and there still is a vast number of documents out there. I mean, there's a focusing process that goes on.
Well, June 30th, we produce documents consistent with our interpretation of the order. July 1st, the train goes off the track because Judge Koukouras is of a mind that he has given us a clear directive on June 9th that we are to do a trial exhibit list in effect. Then we try to comply. We make submissions. We make multiple submissions, and all the time defendants are saying you're still giving us too much. And we go through the meet and confer process, and we go through trying to get to a compliant document. We get to a compliant document, and it is then and only then after a compliant document is provided that we are told, okay, now we're going to move to sanction you. And I think Magistrate Judge Levin, you've got to understand the context of his directive. On July 1, the train goes off the track because Judge Koukouras says, I gave you a direct directive to do something that we don't think he did. So, of course, when it's referred to Magistrate Judge Levin to see if to make findings whether or not we complied with an order that we don't think was entered, it's a foregone conclusion he's going to come to the conclusion we did not comply because we weren't trying to comply with what Judge Koukouras thought we were trying to comply with what was written in that June 9 order. And I see my time is up unless the panel has other questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thanks.
Ms. Perman?
May it please the Court, my name is Debbie Berman, and I represent Paramount Pictures, Fireworks, and Tolan Robbins, the appellees in this matter. I'd like to start with Mr. Roach's challenge to point out cases to this court, where the court has held that if there's two reasonable interpretations, the non-defamatory one prevails. And that, quite frankly, is the law in the Illinois Supreme Court and has been the law in this circuit, and there's no reason to change it or any case support for Mr. Roach's arguments that it should be changed. To start out with Bryson, in Bryson, they used the name Bryson. That is not a case of an unnamed plaintiff. And in fact, that was a dispositive factor for that court to hold that it was not capable of an innocent construction because it ruled that Bryson was such a unique name that it indicated that it was the plaintiff and there was no possible reasonable interpretation that it could be referring to anybody else. And so that's why it reversed the motion to dismiss.
Ms. Berman, let me ask you this. I mean, we have sort of two things on the table. One is whether there is an innocent construction or not for these materials. And then another sort of one step removed is who ultimately decides whether there is any innocent construction. And since this comes to us on summary judgment, the most immediate question before us is whether on the record as presented to the district court, it should have been for the jury to decide that there was simply no innocent construction from all of this, or whether for whatever reason, allocations of burden of proof or the like, it was permissible for the judge to make that call.
Your Honor, in prior opinions, the court has made a distinction between the innocent construction standard to determine if there's any non-defamatory reasonable interpretation, which they have said in the past is an issue of law, which this court, in the prior opinions, it was an issue of fact, though there are no disputed issues of fact. One views the movie and can make that determination. There are no disputed issues of fact. And then there's the second part of Chapsky, which Mr. Roach has referred to in his briefs, is if you don't meet that first standard, which, as you have said earlier in questioning Mr. Roach, that the court did not make the determination that Paramount could not satisfy the first standard in its prior ruling. It said, we're sending it back, and we want you to put evidence in to see if there's an innocent construction or not. It's only if the court determines that there is no innocent construction, then it goes to the jury to decide if people actually interpreted it in the non-defamatory manner. That's a two-stage step. We're nowhere near the second stage.
Is there a different standard in this case with regard to summary judgment?
No, Your Honor, and I suggest the Pope case, which was decided by Judge Wood and you were on the panel, applied the standard that I just articulated on summary judgment and found that the statements were capable of an innocent construction and affirmed summary judgment. And in that case, you also made it perfectly clear that the court is not to balance reasonable constructions, nor is it necessary to conclude that the statement cannot be construed in a defamatory way. And that is exactly the burden in this case. It is the plaintiff's burden to show that there is no reasonable non-defamatory construction.
And how do you think a plaintiff would go about doing that? I mean, they have in the record things from the media. They've got the affidavits, such as they are. And I guess another question related to that is, what's the relevant universe of people? Is it the universe of people, say, in the Chicago area who might know who Mr. Muzikowski is? Is it, you know, the human race? Is it, you know, the United States? Who is it, actually, we need to look at?
The audience, the reasonable, the test is the reasonable viewer. It's not limited to reasonable viewers who know Mr. Muzikowski. It's reasonable viewers. That's what the case law has uniformly said. It's the person that's going to buy the ticket, go see the movie, or they reasonably conclude it's Mr. Muzikowski. And there are numerous non-defamatory interpretations of who that character is. For example, in the last appeal, you recall that Mr. Muzikowski said, I'm the star of the book. If you read the book, you inevitably have to conclude it's me. But if you read the book, you see that Mr. Muzikowski is not the star of the book. The book is about a baseball team that he has no involvement with. It is part of his league, but he is not a coach on that team. And instead, the main coach, Bill Bowman, is listed on 200-some-odd pages of that book, and many of the similarities that are pointed out in their papers are things that actually occurred to Mr. Bowman.
Where did the Associated Press article come from?
Your Honor, I don't know. That article came out before the movie came out. So how that can be indicative of someone having seen the movie and concluded that it was Mr. Muzikowski.
So you would be able to say, if asked on behalf of your client, Paramount had nothing to do with the story, with the article?
That's correct, Your Honor. And to the contrary, what happened in...
Who do you think did it?
Well, during the filming of the movie, which is when that article came out, Mr. Muzikowski and other of his colleagues organized very large protests and issued press releases saying, the movie's Mr. Muzikowski, the movie's Mr. Muzikowski, the movie's Mr. Muzikowski. And for one of the articles, I believe it was the Naples Reporter, there is evidence in the record that Mr. Muzikowski actually talked to that person and said, the movie is me. Therefore, it's not quite surprising that the reporter reports that the movie is about Mr. Muzikowski. Mr. Muzikowski poisoned the well by telling every single person he met, including the press, and it was picked up by the press. The press releases that they issued that the movie is about me. Paramount did issue several press releases in this case. The first press release was issued when the filming started, and they said it's a fictionalized version of journalist Dan Coyle's book about his meeting Dan Coyle's true life experiences coaching. When the protests started, Paramount issued another press release. It said Paramount Pictures' film Hardball is a dramatic work of fiction. While it is inspired by real events, all the characters in this film are fictional. That press release was picked up by the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, the AP, local television stations. And then when they were doing additional press, they said it was inspired by Dan Coyle's book. Mr. Muzikowski's name has never been mentioned in any thing, in the press kit, the press release, or anything. The press kit said that it's inspired by Dan Coyle's book, an account of Coyle's own experience coaching a youth baseball team in Cabrini Green's housing project. And as a matter of fact, people could reasonably conclude that Coyle is that O'Neill represents Coyle, the author of the book who was describing his experiences coaching. Or they could also reasonably conclude that it's no real person. It could be an amalgamation of lots of people or no real person. And indeed, Mr. Muzikowski...
About interviews on local television, who did those?
Mr. Muzikowski was interviewed on local television saying that the movie was about him, both when the movie was being filmed and right before it was released when Mr. Muzikowski brought his motion for a temporary restraining order. He was on the press promoting his own book. In his own book, which he released right before the movie came out, it says this movie is about me, and he told everyone on local television that the movie is about him. So it's hard to distinguish. It's impossible to say that someone would have reached that conclusion on their own. They certainly didn't reach it from Paramount, because Paramount never once believed that this movie is about Mr. Muzikowski and took great pains to tell the audience, the potential audience, that this is a fictional movie based on Dan Coyle's book about Dan Coyle's experiences.
But, you know, the fact that Mr. Muzikowski was saying these things doesn't exclude the possibility that it was about him. I mean, one of the family members of this new movie that's out, the Flight 93 movie, might say, this is about my family member. And that movie, you know, we're in this gray zone between pure fiction and documentary, and this book and this movie lay somewhere in the middle. So Mr. Muzikowski could be saying it's about me, and it might indeed be about him. Just because he said it, in other words, doesn't negate the possibility. that it's
correct,
about.
Correct, Your Honor. And actually, it is not Paramount's burden to show that a reasonable interpretation is that it's not about Mr. Musikowski. Because as the law is very clear, as you stated in the Pope opinion, and as the Illinois Supreme Court stated, they explicitly addressed this issue, and they said the rigorous standard of the modified innocent construction will favor defendants in per se actions, and that a non-defamatory interpretation must be adopted if it is reasonable. The tougher standard is warranted because of presumption of damages in per se actions. And I want to add that Mr. Musikowski did in his initial complaint have a per quad cause of action to which the innocent construction rule does not apply. Mr. Musikowski did not plead special damages and instead chose to stand on his complaint and come up to this court without having pled special damages, and therefore this court held that he was precluded from doing so. And in discovery, it actually turned out that there's no evidence that he lost any clients, customers, or anything because of the movie. To the contrary, his business grew during that time. So it's not that the innocent construction would preclude any cause of action, that he could make all the arguments he wants to make. It's the innocent construction precludes a per se cause of action because under a per se, he doesn't have to prove any damages. They're presumed. So the Illinois Supreme Court has set a very high bar for that. And Mr. Musikowski chose, when he decided to appeal last time, to go only under that cause of action. He could have attempted to make all the arguments that he's showing now where he doesn't have to show that there are. You know, Mr. Roach said, well, that's an impossible standard to show that no one would reasonably conclude it's anybody but him. But that is the high standard that the per se cause of action requires in this court because of by Illinois and adopted by this court because of presumed damages.
Are we left with, say, in the local media, in the Chicago media, television, for example, with only the plaintiff's version that it was him?
No, Your Honor. There was the press release, which I read to you earlier, which was reported on local television stations and in local newspapers, that Paramount says that it is a fictional movie that portrays no real people, though it's tied to the book.
So you rely heavily on this phrase inspired by, right, the book. Inspired by but not an account, because the book at least purported to be an account of this man's experience.
It's an account of Mr. Coyle's
experience.
But that's
experience. Right. But in one of the chapters of the book, in Mr. Coyle's experience, is about Mr. Musikowski. So the book itself is not supposed to be a work of fiction. The book itself is a work of nonfiction, right?
That's correct.
So then you go the next step and you say, okay, the movie's inspired by this piece of nonfiction, but itself is fiction.
Actually, all the advertisement at most only ever said inspired by a true story. That's what the advertisement said. It's inspired by a true story. Didn't say it is a true story. It didn't say it's a documentary. And it is a true story. There is an inner-city urban youth baseball league where predominantly white coaches, including people like Bill Bowman and Dan Coyle and the rest of the people on their team, coach disadvantaged African-American children. That is true. That exists. And there are a number of vignettes in the movie concerning the kids, like having a chubby, asthmatic player who was on Bill Bowman's team, had nothing to do with Mr. Musikowski. There is a chubby, black player on Connor O'Neill's team. That is how it's inspired by a true story. The setting of an urban baseball league coach, and if you recall it, if you've seen the movie, it was supposed to be Mr. O'Neill's friend who was a, investment banker whose company sponsored the team, was supposed to coach, and then he didn't coach and made him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is that kernel of a real thing is there. That's what inspired by a true story mean. It doesn't say this is the true story of Bob Musikowski.
How does Flight 93 work into that? Is that a true story or what?
Your Honor, I'm not sure based on what I've seen on television. I believe it's based on actual events, though the studio's been clear, at least what I've read in the newspaper, that a lot of the events that have gone on inside were things that had to be made up. But yes, it's inspired by true. I mean, that flight did crash, and there is a youth baseball league in Chicago. I think we're left with the fact that there are many potential interpretations of reasonable interpretations. The only limitation that Illinois puts on is that it must be reasonable. And in Bryson, she was named, so that was the issue. The thing that they found was not reasonable, and what they go in great lengths about is the fact that the defendants were arguing that the word slut could mean bully. And the Illinois Supreme Court said, wait a minute, that is just not reasonable, and we're not going to stretch to any innocent construction to grant it for the defendants. It has to be reasonable ones. But they're clear, confirmed in Anderson, confirmed in your – and I'd like to remind you that Mr. Musikowski raised this precise issue in the last appeal. He argued to you he only has to show a reasonable interpretation. This court rejected that, and indeed, in the prior opinion, you have held that if there are two – however, if a statement is capable of two reasonable constructions, one defamatory and one innocent, the innocent one will prevail. And there are many innocent, reasonable innocent constructions. People might think it's Mr. Bowman, Mr. Coyle, an amalgamation of people. And if that's the standard on per se causes of action, the defendants win because the Illinois Supreme Court has decided because of the significant threat of presumed damages.
Could we go back to the operation of the innocent construction rule as apparently both a legal inquiry as a threshold matter but also a potential factual defense? And maybe I'm misunderstanding the Illinois cases on this, but it seems to me that it functions in both senses, that it's as an initial matter a legal inquiry, and it functions as an objective test by reference to the reasonable person standard and so forth, and that if there are competing reasonable interpretations, the innocent one prevails as a matter of law, and that's the operation of the rule as a legal rule of law, but that if the plaintiff survives that, then there's also a possibility for an innocent construction actual factual defense. Is that a fair understanding of the case law or no?
The Chapsky, which is a seminal case in Illinois, set forth a standard for the plaintiff to demonstrate that the movie is of, or that the statement is of and concerning him, and it has a two-part test. The first is the one that you described. It's an inquiry as to whether there's a reasonable non-defamatory construction, and if so, the case is over for a per se cause of action. If the plaintiff is able to demonstrate that the only reasonable construction is defamatory, then it actually goes to the jury to decide if people actually understood it in the way that the plaintiff is proposing. But we're in the first stage. That initial determination was never made by this court on appeal last time. They said, we're going to send it back down and you put evidence in. And I'd like to remind the court that when the case came up here last time, the movie was not in the record. The book was not in the record. The things you need to view the statements in context, and really they were only on the black and white page of the complaint because they were not included. And when you view the movie in its context, it's clear that there are many non-defamatory reasonable constructions, several of which I've identified for you today, and that is a big difference than the last posture that we came up. We were constrained by the allegations in the complaint, many of which are not accurate, including
If I could interrupt, the other problem here is that the two categories of defamation per se that were invoked here, the commission of a crime or imputation of commission of a crime and imputation of some sort of impropriety in one's profession or occupation, the O'Neill character apparently isn't depicted as having committed a crime. As I haven't seen the movie, but I'm just taking what I've read in the materials as true, and he is not depicted as an unlicensed securities broker, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We were constrained by the allegations in the complaint, and the court said that he's pled a defamatory per se category on the very narrow category of theft. There's no theft shown in the movie, and being an unlicensed broker. But when you view the movie, it's clear that Mr. O'Neill's unemployed. He's not purporting to be a broker, licensed or otherwise, and those things just don't exist in the movie. Thank you.
You want to address the sanction?
Your Honor, I think it's fully briefed in our pleadings, unless you have any specific questions. The order was clear. Judge Kokor several times said explicitly during that hearing what he wanted done. They didn't do it. I called them. I gave them the transcript. I said, this is what you need to do. You know, they identified blank letterhead. Even if they thought the order is what they say, which is that they had to identify documents that support their contentions, blank letterhead and printouts from encyclopedia.com defining tort in no way could comply with either order. And then even after we stand in front of Judge Levin for 3 hours arguing, and they say, look, if we haven't complied, we will. Instead of doing any objections to his finding of willfulness, they file a document with Judge Kokoris that says of their intent to comply with his order, meaning trial exhibits, and then they still include things like the printout from encyclopedia.com. So whatever the order was, though clearly we think the order was for them to, Judge Kokoris was quite upset because their defense for not identifying the documents that support their contentions is that the defendants could do it as easily as he could. And Judge Kokoris said, well, no, you need to do that. And you're now going to have to do, because you've taken that position, you're not going to have to identify trial exhibits. And it was very clear. And there were two jurists who listened very carefully to this matter down below. And I think the evidence is clear that they did not abuse their discretion, which is a very tough standard for the Schuyler Roach firm to comply with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.